So what we want to do today is to take the ideas that we had for echoes and extend them. In particular, we want to add the idea that the frequency that a spin is processing at is not constant. So, you know, we have the Planck equations, which I'm not going to write down again, but they have a term that is precession that comes from the Zeeman Hamiltonian. And if we wrote this in the rotating frame, so I make that delta omega instead of omega, then we saw that that delta omega could take on a range of values. And so we say that there's a classical probability distribution describing delta omega. And we saw a nice result that that distribution need not limit our control over the quantum system. So if we said, if we looked at the Hahn echo experiment, that at this particular moment where the system has processed for some time delta, we've applied another pulse, in this case a pi pulse, and we allow it to process for another time delta, at this particular moment, all the spins are back in phase. And that the spins lose their dependence on delta omega. And that's what we mean by an echo. And we gave a model for where this delta omega noise could come from. We said, let's take the field as a function of position, and we'll say that it's some static field plus a gradient in the whole thing is in the z direction. And of course, by going to the rotating frame, the static field's going to drop out, right? So we're not going to worry about that. This is the only piece we want. And here we have a linear gradient of the magnetic field. Now, I cheat a little bit by giving you a partial of the field in only one direction. And then, you know, you sit there and be appalled by saying, hey, Maxwell doesn't allow that. What about everything else in the Jacobian of the field? I'm not going to show it to you, but you can show yourself that if I have a term, let's say, if I have dbz dz, then I could, you know, I need another term. It could be dbx dx. And you can show me that that term would not be important, that it would have no influence on average over the spins. In other words, if we have a static field in the z direction, any static field that we would apply in a transverse direction, as long as it's small, and remember that this is really small, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. As long as it's small, won't have any influence. So we'll take this piece, and we'll look at it. And now by saying that the magnetic field varies over space, over location. It allows us a really simple picture of the spin system and a nice, easy way of putting in dynamics. And so we made a plot here. We said, let's look at two aspects. The first is we defined a wave vector, k. And the wave vector was easy to understand if we went back and said, what is m plus as a function of time in this sample? It would be the integral of the probability that we have some spin at z, e to the I gamma dbz dz times z times t. Dz. And then I could define k as being gamma dbz dz times t. And it's easy to see that this nicely has units of 2 pi per centimeter. If I keep remembering to put the factors of 2 pi in there, at least it would have those units. Here we have hertz per Gauss, and then we have Gauss per centimeter. We have time, so we get 2 pi per centimeter. So it's nicely a wave number. And of course, it allows us to rewrite this as the integral of p of z e to the I k t k z dz. And as an aside, you immediately recognize that as a Fourier transform. And if we were in a course on medical imaging, then I would say, well, this is what allows you to do MRI. That we take a person, we put them into a magnetic field, we put a linear magnetic field gradient over them. This person has some distribution of spins over some over any axis. I can collect this signal. I can collect this signal now as a function of k. Because, of course, k is linearly proportional to time. So I can just say, oh, wow, I'm collecting it as a function of k. And then once I have that signal, I can take the inverse Fourier transform and tell you what the spin distribution is. And it's a simple task to go from one dimensions to three dimensions, but we're not going to do it because we're a little bit behind anyways. So now then we say, okay, we've defined k. And we plotted out k on this picture. And we saw that, of course, k increases and that the action of this pi pulse was to change k from positive to negative. And then it would increase again. And it would cross zero right at this point where, of course, all the spins are back in line. And further, we could make a plot where we had z as a function, and we plotted m sub x. And at this point, let's plot minus m sub y. All the spins are in line with each other. And we saw that the action of k is to wrap them up into a helix. And the pitch of that helix is exactly k. And so then we can understand how this works. And of course, the action of the pi pulse is to invert that. And at the moment that we get back to k equals zero, all the spins are back in line. And if you want the phases of that to work out, that should be a Y pulse. Okay, and then everything comes a nice, simple picture. Yeah? Okay. Now, what I want to add is I want to add emotion. I want to say, imagine that there's a displacement to the spins. If I want to add random noise, let's add something that's truly random. And molecular diffusion is a good model of something being truly random. And so here I could plot out the probability of spins moving by some amount versus delta z. And we'll put zero there. And of course, we expect that probability to be a Gaussian, right? And so now, we can write that down. Come back here. Let's put D there. I do this too often. It's not the same as this function, right? So you recall the functional form of a Gaussian, and that sigma is a standard deviation of that, and this is equal to 2dt, where d is the diffusion coefficient. Now let's talk about this for a second before we go through the math, although the math is trivial. Let me plot out this way. So there's z, and let's plot m sub x and m sub y. Etc. I want you to recognize a piece of the analysis we're doing. Notice that when we describe the effect of the experiment, I've never had to say what that functional form piece of z is. In fact, it doesn't enter into my picture at all. Right? All I'm doing is showing you that if there was a spin at that location, this is how it behaves. And having defined for you how the spin would behave at every position, then we've completely defined the problem in general. And, you know, we can go home. You can't go home yet, but, you know, conceptually. And of course, we've done this in reciprocal space to make it nice and simple for us. So we get a compact representation. And of course, it's lovely. In reciprocal space, we have this one parameter. What is the wave number? We know the wave number. We know everything. Yeah? OK. We're going to do the same thing over here. I say, oh, I have, at some instant in time, so some instant in time, or it's an instant in k, if you like. We've got a grating there. And now I'm going to allow the spins to diffuse by some conditional probability displacement. So that means that if I took a spin, you know, this one, well, it is going to be relocated over that distribution. And this one is going to be relocated over that distribution. and every spin is going to be relocated over that distribution. And so formally, of course, we can describe that as a convolution. So we can say that if we had two functions, f of g convolved with g of z, this is equal to the integral of f. I want to do one more piece here. This convolution evaluated at some point, that this is equal to the integral f of z, f of chi minus z, dz integrated over all space, right? I'm trusting people have all seen convolutions before. Good. Now notice what happens. If I convolve for a cosine function, then the convolution is an isometric function. So that for every particle that moves to the right, there must be a particle that moves to the left. For every particle that leaves a place, there's a particle that comes back. And we should expect that, in fact, the frequency, the value of k, doesn't change. The amplitude of the grating can change, but k doesn't change. And if you've seen the central limit theorem, how many people have seen the central limit theorem? Only a few. It's a useful theorem to catch up in your life someday. It would say the same thing. But let's analyze it in a much simpler form. Let's say that I have this value of k. Well, then I know spatially that I have a term that is e to the I k times z. And let's give that a particular value. Let's call it k naught, that we're interested not in some random k, but we're interested in this particular k, which we've defined as 2 pi over k naught. And I want to convolve that. I'm going to say, oh yeah, the grating is right there. And now I'm going to convolve it with this function, PD of delta z. There's a lovely result that is called the Wiener-Kitchen theorem, or the convolution theorem, or some other names. So if I define the two Fourier transforms of f and g to be capital F and g, then the convolution is the inverse Fourier transform of the products of those two. And that is trivial to prove. Okay? So I'm not going to do it for you. But if you take that definition, you stick in the Fourier transforms, it all comes out. All you have to do is change the orders of integration. So let's take this. We're going to take this and take the Fourier transform. Well, the Fourier transform of a helix, of course, is just a delta function. So it's a delta function at k minus k naught. We're going to multiply that by the Fourier transform, I'll indicate that with a tilde, of K. And the Fourier transform of a Gaussian, you must have seen that in your condensed matter classes, is just a Gaussian. And so P tilde D of K is equal to e to the minus k squared sigma squared over 2. And because I've correctly normalized this, then there's no coefficient in front of this, right? Because the area is equal to 1. And if I looked at the k equals 0 component, then that corresponds to the area, right? So 1 is equal to 1, life is good. All right, so we have this. Now, the delta function only samples. So now at the end of the day, this looks like, I don't know, I keep putting an I there. E to the k squared naught, k naught squared, sigma squared over 2. So that's just the sampling property. We take the inverse Fourier transform here. And the inverse Fourier transform, we still have k at that point, right? Everything else is 0. And so we get the term that is e to the I k naught z. As promised, we get back the grating, but it's attenuated by e to the minus k naught squared sigma squared over 2. And this is the attenuation of a fixed grating with diffusion. So I'm calling this helix a grating because the result is actually much more general than what we've seen. So if I have a grating and I allow it to be blurred out, then the grating is attenuated. And we know exactly how much. Depends upon the blurring. And this, you know. I mean, take your camera. Look at a set of lines. Unfocus your camera, right? And they blur. And you don't create new lines in between. You don't make them closer. You don't make them further apart. They only blur. Okay? So it's a long-winded way of saying the same thing. Now, we're not quite there yet. Because what we've calculated is the attenuation for a fixed grating. But of course, in our experiment, the grating's not fixed. Our experiment says that we have this pi over 2 pulse. And they'll plot k here. And k is increasing linearly in time. So we need to integrate that over this. And you know what we expect to see? That when k is equal to 0, we can move the spins anywhere we like and there's no influence, right? And as k becomes a larger and larger number, the influence of moving them becomes more and more pronounced. So the overall attenuation is equal to e to the minus integral k naught squared. And let me remember here that sigma is the square root of 2 dt. So I'm going to rewrite this as e to the minus k naught squared dt. Okay? So this will be the integral of k squared, not k naught squared, k squared, d dt, integrate from 0 to delta. That was our value. Now k, we have to remember that k is a function of time, and so it's useful to put back in that dependency. So this is equal to e to the minus integral 0 to delta gamma squared 2 pi squared, the gradient strength squared times t squared d dt. So life is easy, right? It's equal to e to the minus 2 pi squared gamma squared dbz dz squared d t cubed divided by 3. But I grab that factor of t here, and I integrate it to delta, so let me keep it as delta. So this is e to the minus k naught squared d delta divided by 3. Okay, just again, making the association that k naught is equal to 2 pi delta. So now we see how the system attenuates. That the bigger the k is, the faster it attenuates. Now, this isn't the whole experiment, right? What this value is telling us is how the signal attenuates up until this point. But I can't see the signal there anyways, right? Because it's wrapped up in this helix, and so if I integrate it over to the helix, the signal is going to be zero. So I still need to give an echo. So we put our pi pulse back in, wait for some time, delta, and we're looking here, and we saw that the k-space trajectory went like that. And of course, the attenuation over this path must be exactly the same as the attenuation over that path, because the attenuation comes in as k-squared. And so the attenuation of the echo here is e to the minus k naught squared d delta two delta divided by 3. And that's to say that the echo that we would see here is reduced in intensity by that value. Okay, so now this isn't so surprising, right? It says, if we have random motion, then because an individual spin is sitting at one frequency here and another frequency there, that we expect that we shouldn't be able to refocus the motion. Right? So we say, okay, this makes sense. This is telling us the limits of control we have in the presence of noise. Okay? So that you're saying not only a distribution of frequencies, right? Here we're saying not only is there a range of delta omega, but of course they're changing over time. But now, we look at a result that was introduced by Carr and Purcell. So Purcell is still the same Purcell from the Nobel Prize for NMR. And what Carr and Purcell asked is, imagine I give you two experiments. I give you this one, And we're looking here. And then I give you another experiment. Where we change this. All right. My spacing isn't very good. But you'll get the idea. The echoes line up at the same place, right? So, and they ask the question of what is the difference in attenuation over these experiments? All right, so I want you to take 2 minutes to come up with an answer for that. And the way you're going to start is by drawing the k-space trajectory for those two experiments. So we're going to keep the gradient term fixed. So that's the same for both experiments. But otherwise, you're going to just calculate k for the trajectories for the pi pulses we have. Did you, by chance, go over this 90-90 pulse in?
Yes, we did, yes.
Fantastic, and they understood it.
I think so.
Life is even better. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Just to say it's a different time.
So is it like, so for this first experiment,
yeah,
would that be the attenuation, like with factor 8 delta, and then here factor 4 delta 1?
Yes.
Okay, that's right.
But so I should put you to the board now. What does the k-space trajectory look like in this case? And what does it look like here?
So same thing, but less lines.
Less lines and?
The
slope is the same, right? So that's the key piece. That since the slope is the same, we go further out. Yep. Everyone sees that? Okay, so the Carpersell sequence which is, last class we said, somebody puts a qubit in your lap, you do a Rabi, you do a Ramsey, you do an inversion recovery, you do a Hahn echo. And after you, in the Hahn echo, so okay, the Rabi says, what's omega 1? The Ramsey says, what's T2 star? Then you go and you say, well, I'll do the Hahn echo. And the Hahn echo, I'm sorry, you do the inversion recovery. It says, what's T1? Then you do the Hahn echo. And that says, what's T2 if I count only the time-independent noises in the system? It's a funny thing. I say time-independent noise. So imagine that you're sitting there and measuring a flux qubit. So every experiment that you do takes a millisecond, but you're doing 10 to 6 of them. And so what I mean by saying that that system doesn't change in time is that during the 1 millisecond, the frequency is constant, right? But over the 2 hours it takes you to do the averaging, the frequency changes because it's changing over your ensemble, but it's not changing during a measurement. Okay? Now here, then after you've done all that, you say, okay, now I'm going to crank up the Carpersell sequence because I want to know if there's frequencies that are varying slowly in time, but during the experiment. And so you create all of these periodic echoes, right? We get an echo here. We get an echo here and here and here. And there. And remember that the attenuation comes as e to the minus k naught squared d delta over 3 with a factor of 2 there because we have an echo. So this is for the Hahn experiment. And now then we say, oh, no. Let's say that I want to measure at a fixed time. Call this time capital T. So we're going to measure at fixed time capital T. I'm going to choose the number of echoes. So N is the number of echoes. So in this experiment, there's 2 echoes. In this experiment, there's 4 echoes, right? And if I have N, we know that T is equal to 2N times delta. So if I choose capital T and I choose N, delta's fixed, right? And I know that the attenuation here is the attenuation here is the attenuation here, etc., right? That they're always the same. So then it becomes pretty easy. The attenuation is e to the minus 2 pi squared gamma squared dBz dz squared d times the time that we have. So that's 2n over t squared. And then the number of such intervals, which is 2n. This can't be right. Let's try to get that correct. Delta is t divided by 2n squared. Delta is t divided by 2n. It comes as delta squared, so I square it. And then we say, well, how many are there? There's 2n of them. And we have, and that's it. Did I make a mistake? No. And we have this time here, which is t over 2n. And if I've done this right, I wrote it down completely a different way in my notes. That this better come out to be e to the minus k delta squared, I don't need that. E to the minus 2 pi gamma dBz dz squared d delta squared t divided by 3. And I certainly dropped the factor of 3 there, right? So yeah, that's okay. All right. So here's the overall attenuation that we have in that system. Now, let's take that and say that the attenuation is t divided by some characteristic time, right? It's going to be an exponential process, and let's call it td, and then td is equal to 3 divided by 2 pi squared gamma squared dbz dz squared times d times delta squared. Right, so that's a characteristic time. And of course, we want that characteristic time to be long. Right, the longer that characteristic time is, the less attenuation that we have. So I want this longer is better. Therefore, delta should be as short as possible. And Hahn published this result when he was a postdoc. And then a young faculty member at State School suggested that you should look at diffusion this way. Carl Purcell, of course, had published this. But they hadn't really internalized what it meant. They did the math, but they didn't really understand what they had. And so Ed Stachel tried to publish it. And he says, look at what happens. Even though I have random motion, by putting in more and more refocusing pulses, I can make it less and less important, and in fact, I can make the motion effectively go away. And it seemed like a surprising thing. It was unfortunately so surprising that he didn't get tenure, although it's a very important result, and it's used throughout the field. He had a great career at Monsanto, but not at Wisconsin, where he was a faculty member for a brief time. And here, you can try to understand this. What makes it possible that by rotating the system over and over again quickly, we're able to suppress a random event is because the sensitivity of that random event depends upon how long we're looking. And so if we look fast, then it appears that we reduce the sensitivity. It almost sounds like the quantum Zeno effect, if you guys know the quantum Zeno effect. We'll talk about it briefly next week. But it's not, right? Because here, you really have a random process that you're trying to squeeze out. Now, the diffusion coefficient has units centimeters squared per second, right? That's telling us how fast, it's telling us the rate at which a particle can sample the area around it. We can convert that into a diffusion that is hertz per second, hertz squared per second, which then fits very well over here. That, of course, putting in this spatial model of why we have the fluctuating Zeeman interaction isn't key to this understanding. We could have any model that changes the frequency. And in fact, we can do away with the model altogether, and we can just say, oh, I have a diffusive process that's going to vary the frequency of my qubit. And now we can ask, how fast? If I have a diffusive model now, so I combine these two, and I get a D of frequency, how fast things are going. And then I ask, okay, within the resources that we've given here, how much of this motion can we remove? How long can we make that? And hopefully you can see that we can't take delta to zero, because in fact, we really do have to give those pi pulses. And we know the frequency of giving those pi pulses, because remember, we had another term here, this so-called nutation term, or RF, which has a frequency of omega 1. And omega 1 comes with some real cost. You come into the lab, there's a big amplifier there. That's our value of omega 1, how much watts of power we put into there. So delta is going to be something like pi divided by omega 1. And so now you can reduce this and say, okay, the best you can do for D is that. Okay, so that's our limit. But we should remember that even though noise isn't temporally, even though noise is changing in time, we can still remove it. Now, since we can remove it, We can do something even nicer. So let's draw the Carpuscell sequence yet again. So we're just going to repeat that piece over and over and over and over again. Just stitch them together. And at the end, we'll make a measurement. And notice what happens. That if I had a noise, so normally when we think about noise, we think about the spectral density of noise. Which is just to say, what is the amplitude? So if I look at a given frequency, how much noise is there at the frequency? And a pretty universal curve looks like this. Somewhere we have some white noise. And although we can promise that it doesn't go on forever, we're only going to measure over some limited range anyways. So it's what we see. There's somewhere, some area where the amplitude doesn't vary. There's some area where we have 1 over F noise. Where the amplitude falls down quickly as we increase the noise. And it's a nice piece of physics to look at someday that if you have shot noise, if you believe that electrical noise comes eventually from electrons, and a resounding yes, you believe that would be good, that that you necessarily have to have something that looks like this 1 over F noise. It simply says, as I look deep down, at some point, there's an individual electron, which is there or not. And at some point, there's always some resonances in your circuit that no matter how hard you've built it, there's always some resonance frequency or many of them floating around. And so we say, oh, okay, I want to know what this spectral density is. And if I had a frequency whose period matches 2 delta, then you can see that the Carpuscell sequence doesn't remove that, right? That one stays. And so a nice result is that we can use the Carpuscell sequence as by changing delta and looking at the resultant attenuation to map out the spectral density. And so we can learn about the time variation of our noise. So we can learn the amplitude of the noise, and we can learn the frequency dependence of the noise. And now then, we know just about everything we'd ever want to know about 1 qubit. Yeah? All right. I'm going to, for those of you that attended recitation yesterday, you saw this experiment. And you saw that there were 5 echoes that you get from this experiment. And that there is 1 particularly nice echo that shows up here. That's called the stimulated echo. Yes? Maybe? Yes. All right. I want you to relook at this experiment. And the way I want you to think about it is that these 2 pulses effectively form a pi pulse, and that for this echo, just for that echo, this time does not matter. So the lovely thing about the stimulated echo experiment is it gives us a way of asking, in two separate time intervals, are the spins evolving the same rate? Because there'll be an echo, provided that the Zeeman frequency here and the Zeeman frequency here are exactly the same. Then we'll get a full echo. If they vary, we won't. And so this gives us a way of asking, what's the probability that we had omega during this time and omega during this last time separated by some time t? All right, so let's call that 0 and omega of t. So it gives us this conditional probability. And when this was first thought of, IBM took out the patent on it. And they said, hey, I could use this to store a quantum state. And so that was, in my opinion, the first patent on qubits. And that's in the early 60s. Now, of course, they didn't call it a qubit. But they did call it the state of one spin one half particle, which seems pretty close to a qubit. And they seriously considered using this for memory because the memory that we had at the time was core memory, which was nice little magnetic donuts. It was wonderful. When you pulled one of these boards out, you could count how many bits you could store because you could see each and every one. So let's stop here. We know now everything I want you to take away for one qubit. And then on Monday, we'll look at what's the different story when we add another qubit. Thanks.